Okay, welcome to day four of topology. All right, so let's start with page one here of my, I don't know if you want to call them slides or notes. And we're going to be focusing on sections 2.3 to 2.5, looking at open sets and closed sets in the context of subsets of the plane, and understanding some basic properties about them. Now really, 90% of it, we're just looking at the simple case subsets of the line. Then we'll generalize to subsets of the plane towards the end of this lecture. An important notion here is the notion of distance. So for reals, distance is defined as usual. It's just x minus y is the difference between two reals, and then that difference is either positive or negative, but forget about the sign, take the absolute value. That's the distance. And we generalize this a bit by now talking about the distance between a real and a set of reals. And that is a simple idea. What you want to do is see how close you can get to some real X with the reals in some set A. So you take the greatest lower bound of all the distances between real X and reals Y, where Y is in A. Right. So the reason we can't take a minimum in general is because the minimum of these distances might not exist. So if X is 1 and A is, say, the open interval from 2 to 3, then the distances from 1 to reals in the open interval 2 to 3 is just, well, you take anything strictly between 2 and 3 and you subtract 1 and you get a positive number, so you don't have to apply the absolute value thing. So you just get an open interval from 1 to 2. Now, this open interval has no minimum, of course, because if you have anything greater than 1, like say 1.1, that is not the least thing greater than 1.1, because there's 1.01, and then there's 1.001. So there is no least thing greater than 1. So we just take the next best thing, the greatest lower bound. So 1 is less than or equal to everything in the interval from 1 to 2, and that's the greatest thing, less than or equal to everything in that interval. So visually this makes sense. If you have a dot at 1, and then you have the open interval from 2 to 3, excluding endpoints, it really does look like the distance between the dot and the interval is 1. Okay. Now, there's another related concept, which is that of diameter. If you're still thinking about a set A of reals, its diameter, capital D of A, is just the what's called the least upper bound or supremum of all the distances between points both in A now. So for any two points in A, you could look at their distance. Or you could trivially look at one point and measure the distance to itself, if such a point is in your set. And you take the least upper bound if it exists of all these points. Kind of a trivial remarks here. Technically, the least upper bound of an empty set doesn't exist, so this definition doesn't work if A is empty. Also, if A has no upper bound on all the distances between points in A, then it doesn't have a least upper bound. So this definition only makes sense if that set of distances is non-empty. So in other words, if A is non-empty and the distances between points in A form a bounded set. I mean, it's automatically bounded below by zero. All distances are at least zero. But you also need to be bounded above. Right? And in general, we say that a subset of reals is bounded if that set of distances between points in that set is bounded above, and note that A is bounded if and only if A is bounded below and bounded above. Right? If A was not bounded below, then there would be arbitrarily large negative reals in A. And that means you could pick one real in A and then go as far to the left of that real as you wanted and then find something still further to the left in A, which would mean that you could have two things in A that were as far apart as you wanted. Which would mean A was not bounded because there'd be no bound on the distances between points in A. Likewise, if A is not bounded above, then A is not bounded. But if A is bounded both below and above, say between two reals, let's call them P and Q, then the diameter of A exists, right? Because the furthest any two reals in A could be from each other would be as far apart as P and Q are from each other. So then A is bounded, and moreover, we'd have an upper bound on its diameter of Q minus P. That would be an upper bound on the distances between points in A. It might not be the best upper bound. If it's not the best upper bound, then actually that diameter is smaller. You can improve on that just a little bit. You can state more precisely that the diameter of A is actually equal to the supremum of A minus the infimum of A if the supremum of A and the infimum of A exist, of course. That would be the best P and Q that you could fit A in between, the tightest bounds. So with the real line, the notion of distance is tightly connected with the notion of ordering. And we use this to our advantage all the time when we're trying to do proofs. So, for example, let me remind you of something. I think it's actually in the earlier section 2.2. It's the, I guess you could call it an epsilonic characterization of supremum and likewise infimum. And remember, of course, supremum and infimum are just the Latin words for least upper bound and greatest lower bound. Okay, so if you think about the situation where, say, you have an open interval, like say the open interval 3 to 5, its supremum or least upper bound is 5, and it also has many upper bounds. Like 6, 5.5, 5.1, 20. And for all of these upper bounds, you can tell that 5 is the best and the others are not the best because for something like, say, 5.1, you can look at a small interval of reals to the left of 5.1, right? Namely, for simplicity, look at the interval from 5 to 5.1, and that totally misses the interval from 3 to 5. So that means that, on the other hand, if you take any positive epsilon, and you look at the interval from 5 down to 5 minus epsilon, that is not disjoint from the interval 3 to 5, right? Because you have, say, 5 minus epsilon over 2 in both of those intervals. Now, that means, in particular, five minus epsilon is not an upper bound of the interval from 3 to 5. Because there's things like 5 minus epsilon over 2 that are greater, strictly greater than 5 minus epsilon, yet in the interval from 3 to 5. And so in general, you can say that x is equal to the supremum of A if and only if x is an upper bound of A. And for all positive epsilon, x minus epsilon is not an upper bound of A, and that is equivalent, that last part, not x minus epsilon not being an upper bound of A is equivalent to having A intersect the interval from x minus epsilon to x. because we know that A doesn't hit anything above X. So in terms of intervals, X is the supreme of A if and only if A is a subset of the ray from negative infinity to X, including the endpoint X, and for all positive epsilon, A is not a subset of the interval from X minus epsilon to X, including the endpoint X. And this last not being a subset of, we can, again, as I said, restate that in terms of A being a subset of the ray from negative infinity to X, including X, and for all epsilon greater than zero, A intersects the interval from X minus epsilon to X, including the endpoint X. And by the way, I'm talking about page 2 now, in case it wasn't obvious. Okay. Okay, continuing on page 2, a set of reals is open if, and this will be our definition, there's actually three equivalent definitions given in section 2.3, and so you can use any one of them as your starting point. I'll start with the one in terms of distances, because we just talked about distances on the previous page. So a set of reals is open if and only if, for every x in the set, X is in the interior of the set. So if the set is called A, we say X is an interior point of A. So open means all points are interior points. What does it mean to be interior point? Well, that means to get from X to some place outside the set A, you have to go a positive distance. For example, if you have an open interval, let's say 2 to 7, and then you have any x in that interval, how far do you have to go to get out of the interval from x? Well, you're either going to have to go to 2 or 7, right? If you want to get out, you go to 2 or to 7, or you go to something beyond 2 or beyond 7, but that would take you even further. So the minimum distance you can go is the distance from x to 2 or the distance from x to 7, whichever is shorter. And both of those distances are positive because X is strictly between 2 and 7. So whichever one of those distances is the shorter one, it's still a positive number. So indeed, X is in the interior of this interval from 2 to 7. So every open interval is open in this distance sense. You want to say it in a fancy way, it's open in the metric sense. Metrics are distance functions, as we'll talk about in a bit. More generally, if I have a union of intervals, it could be an arbitrary union, maybe even uncounting my intervals that I union up, just a bunch of open intervals. If I union them up, then A is, A, the union, if that's what I call the union, is open. So any union of open intervals is open. Interestingly, if A is an open set, then A is actually a union of open intervals. How do you prove that? Well, you look at every point that's inside A, and by definition it's an interior point. So that means that there's some distance, delta or whatever you want to call it, that you have to travel to get out of A, starting from some point X and A. So for each point X and A, you can go delta to the left or delta to the right, and that gives you a whole open interval, X minus delta to X plus delta, that fits inside A, because you have to go at least distance, some positive distance delta from X to get out of A. So A is just the union over all X and A of the interval X minus the distance to A complement. And with other endpoint X plus the distance from X to the complement of A. So open sets are unions of open intervals, and unions of open intervals are open sets. You might be a little worried about the terminology, right? I mean, there's kind of, on the one hand, we talk about open sets, and we also talk about open intervals. Well, an open interval is also a set. And fortunately, there's no circularity or contradiction with these definitions, because open intervals were already defined first, just as sets of reals strictly between two fixed reals. And our new usage of open to talk about sets is not in conflict with the old usage for open intervals, because every open interval is an open set, as we discuss. Now, you may have noticed when I was talking about how every point in an open set has some positive distance delta, such that you have to travel that far to get out of the set, meaning the interval from X minus delta to X plus delta is contained in your set, assuming openness. Well, you can turn that around and say that if you have that property, if for every x in your set there is such a delta, then you can then you're actually a union of open intervals of the form x minus delta x plus delta. So you're open. So this is actually an if and only if. So we can say that A is open if and only if for every x in A there exists a delta positive such that the interval from x minus delta to x plus delta is a subset of A. So there's the three characterizations here of openness. And now at the bottom of page 2, a set of reals is called closed if its complement is open. Now, if you turn around, and this is what we're doing on page 3 at the top, if you turn around our three properties, our three characterizations of openness, I guess you could think three equivalent definitions of openness, and you just apply the complement operation and you think about things, you get three equivalent definitions of closed. Okay. Well, in addition to the first definition, so I guess now we have, well, four. So let's see. A set C of reals is closed if and only if for all x in the complement of C, the distance from x to c is positive. That's just applying complements and translating our first version of openness into a characterization of closedness. And then our next version was being a union of open intervals. Now, if we apply complements to that, what does that say? It says that C is a complement of a union of open intervals, if and only if it's closed. Well, what is a complement of a union of open intervals? Well, if you apply De Morgan's law, complements of unions become intersections of complements. Okay. Now, the complement of an open interval is just the union of two closed rays, one going to negative infinity, the other going to positive infinity. And so we actually got two characterizations for the price of one there, using De Morgan's law. And then our last characterization of open sets in terms of for every x there is a delta, such that x minus delta comma x plus delta is a subinterval of a given open set. That now becomes, in terms of complements, we say that C is closed if and only if for all x in the complement of C, there exists a delta greater than zero such that the open interval x minus delta to x plus delta is disjoint from C. Right. Now, some important properties come up now. If O is an open set, and you actually have many open sets, say O sub I, for each I in some index set K, capital I, then the union of all those open sets is again open. So, in other words, arbitrary unions preserve openness. And if you apply De Morgan's laws, which say that the complement of a union is the intersection of the complements, then you get an equivalent property or preservation fact that if you have a bunch of closed sets and you intersect them, you get another closed set. And let's mention also the preservation property that if you have a finite number of open sets, then if you take their intersection, you get an open set. Infinite intersections can break this. For example, if you take the open intervals negative 1 over n to positive 1 over n for all positive integers n, the intersection of all those intervals is just a singleton, 0, just one point. Now, to go from the one point in singleton's 0, namely to go from 0 to anything in the complement of that set, which is just all non-zero reals, you don't have to travel some minimum positive distance. For any delta positive, you can go less than delta and get from 0 to something in the complement of singleton 0. Namely, you can just go distance delta over 2 to go from 0 to delta over 2. So infinitely many open sets can intersect to something not open, but finitely many open sets will intersect to something that's just open. And that's not hard to see in that positive direction there. If you're a point and you're in finitely many open sets all at the same time, then what is the minimum distance you have to travel to get out of the intersection? Right. Well, you're either going to have to go... if you think about it, what does it mean to be out of the intersection? It means to get to... how far do you have to go to get to some point that's not in all of those open sets? If you're not in all those open sets, then that means you're not in at least one of them, okay? So if you can get to another point that's not in all the open sets, then there must be one of your open sets that you're able to get to that way. And so say you travel distance 5 to get from your point X in the intersection to outside of the intersection. That means that point X is in some open set, yet at distance 5 there's a point not in that open set, because you went from X in all the open sets to another point 5 away that is not in one of the open sets. So the distance, the greatest lower bound of all the distances from X to points in the complement of the intersection, is just the minimum of the distance from X, a minimum of the distances, plural, from X to each of the open sets that we're intersecting. Mm-hmm. So each of those distances is positive because each of the sets is open. So we take a minimum of finitely many positive numbers and we get a positive number. Right. And so now you can see how things would break down, you know, in general. Things might break down, and they do in some cases, when you have infinitely many positive distances and you want to try to find a positive lower bound for them. Well, maybe you can't, because you could have infinitely many positive numbers like 1 over 1, 1 over 2, 1 over 3, etc. with greatest lower bound 0. Okay. And the dual of finite intersections preserving openness that we get via De Morgan's laws is that finitely many closed sets, if you take their union, will be closed. Okay, let's go on to page 4. So, on day 3, I talked about a proof, Cantor's first proof of the uncountability of the reals. Right? In the book, they actually give the second proof, which is the diagonalization argument. The way the first proof works is using some key facts about the reals and the greatest lower bound property and least upper bound property. And the book here more carefully goes through some of the details of some things where I asserted they worked at the end, didn't give a full proof. The key point here is what the book calls the nested intervals theorem. If you have some intervals and they're closed, so that means including their endpoints, which is actually equivalent to the intervals being closed in the sense of being closed sets. And you have this whole sequence of intervals, and as you advance along the sequence, you get a subset of what you had before each time. Then we call these intervals nested. Rather, this sequence of intervals are nested. So that's the nested intervals theorem. That if you have a nested sequence of intervals, then the intersection of all those intervals is non-empty. And the proof is it's just the idea that I talked about at the end of day 3. You let, say, X be the supremum or least upper bound of, say, all the left endpoints of these intervals. Let's call them A sub N. And you can let Y be the greatest lower bound or infimum of all the right endpoints of these intervals. Call them B sub N. N ranges over the natural numbers. Now, I claim that X and symmetrically Y are in the intersection. Why? Why are they in there? Well, let's just argue why X is in there, and then a symmetrical, like a mirror image of that argument will explain why Y is there. So why is X in there? Well, because, first of all, let's see that X is greater than or equal to every A sub N. Well, that's just because X is an upper bound, right? X is an upper bound of the set of A sub n's. Okay, so it's greater than or equal to every A sub n. That's just what it means to be an upper bound. Well, why is it less than or equal to every B sub n? Well, let's call it every B sub k is an upper bound of all the A sub n's, right? Because if n is less than or equal to k, then A sub n is less than or equal to A sub k, because the intervals are nested and A sub k is less than or equal to B sub k. And on the other hand, if k is less than or equal to n, if things are the other way around, well, then A sub k A sub n is less than or equal to B sub n, because the intervals are nested, B sub n is less than or equal to B sub k. Okay. So every B sub k, where k ranges over all the natural numbers, is an upper bound of the set of all A sub n's. But x is the least upper bound of all the A sub n's. So x has to be less than or equal to every B sub k. Thus, X is in every interval, I'll use yet a different letter to avoid confusion, every interval A sub M to B sub M, including the endpoints. And a symmetrical argument shows that y is in all the intervals too. Now, there's a minor swindle here in that I didn't actually prove to you that x and y actually exist. That is, how do I know that the set of all A sub n's has a supremum, and symmetrically that the set of all B sub n's has an infimum? Well, that's not too hard. Remember that that's one of the axioms that we're taking about the reals, is that every non-empty set that is bounded above has a least upper bound. And symmetrically, every non-empty set that is bounded below has a greatest lower bound. So x and y do indeed exist, since, for example, clearly, A1, say, is an element of the set of all A sub n. So we're talking about a non-empty set, and we look at all the A sub n's. And on the other hand, we know that, say, B1 bounds that set from the right, from above, right? Every A sub n is less than or equal to B sub 1 because the intervals are nested. Okay. Now, I would like to tell you next about the Heine-Borel theorem. So this is on page 5. So the Heine-Borel theorem, is the concrete example of a very general property that we'll discuss later on in the course called compactness. So the Heine-Borel theorem is a property of closed intervals of reals. That when you abstract away this property into something more generally, you find it's very powerful. But that's for much later. Okay, so let's just state the concrete form. We'll get abstract later. Okay. If I have a closed interval, let's say a comma b, and it's the subset of a union of, you know, lots of intervals, you know, these are all open intervals now. So imagine, say, uncountably many, or just countably infinitely many, or just finitely many open intervals that manage to cover the closed interval a b. In the sense that the closed interval is a subset of their union. Now, if you draw any picture of this situation, you might find that no matter how you try to draw the picture, it seems that you end up with finitely many open intervals that cover your closed interval, and possibly lots of other intervals in your union that are just redundant. And in fact, this is actually something you can prove. So if we cover a closed interval by a union of intervals, then actually only finitely many of those intervals, assuming those that we're covering by open intervals, you only need finitely many of those open intervals to cover the closed interval. Okay. So how do we actually prove this? We prove this with bisection. What you want to do is you actually end up proving the contrapositive. So what you do is you suppose that instead, for all finite subcollections of some family of open intervals, we'll just make it an index family. I think it's simpler that way to read. We suppose that no finite number of these open intervals actually cover our closed interval. And what we're going to do is, supposing that no finite collection of these open intervals can cover the closed interval, we're going to actually find a point that is not covered by any of the open intervals. Now, find is not, you know, literally, I give you the number. It's a abstract proof that such a point must exist. Okay, you have to have lots of information about the particular open intervals that you're using in order to get specific information about what such an x might be. So we're going to find an x in the closed interval AB that is not in any of these open intervals. So we're going to show that if finitely many of your open intervals don't cover this closed interval, then actually all of them are not enough. Okay. So what the bisection part of it is we take this global failure for finite covering and we localize it. How do we localize it? We cut our interval, our closed interval AB in half again and again and again. And at every time we cut in half, we argue that at least one of the two halves must again fail to have a finite cover by our open intervals. Okay. So in general, if you had any closed interval, say some other endpoint, say alpha to beta, that was not covered by finitely many of the intervals from your big index set of interval of open intervals, ci, di, then you cannot have the left half of that interval be finitely covered and the right half of that interval be finitely covered. Because if you did, you could use a finite cover for the left half and a finite cover for the right half put together to make a finite cover for the whole thing. So in that way, the failure of finite covering can be applied to successively smaller and smaller intervals. So we start with our original closed interval a comma b, and we repeatedly cut it in half, each time either picking the left half or the right half, such that we choose a half that is not finitely covered. And every time we cut in half, the diameter decreases by a factor of 2. So let's call the resulting sequence the nth term in the sequence can be the interval a sub n to b sub n. And I'm going on to page 6 now. So, since the diameters of these intervals go down by a factor of 2 at each stage, the diameter of the nth interval is 2 to the minus n times the diameter of the original interval from A to B. Now, you use the nested intervals theorem. So, let's say that we pick x to be how about we let x be the supremum of all the a sub n's. Okay. That, as we argued in the proof of the nested intervals theorem, that x is in all of our nested intervals a sub n, b sub n. And now I want to claim that this x is not in any of the open intervals, C sub I, D sub I. And here's how it goes. If we have I in our big index set, capital I, and C sub I is less than X is less than D sub I, then because X is the supremum of the A sub N's, we can choose N large enough let's start off by saying then for some N, C sub I is not greater than or equal to that A sub N, because otherwise C sub I would be an upper bound of all the A sub N's, but X is the least upper bound. Of the A sub N's. Now, if you look at any larger N, if you go from N to N plus 1, N plus 2, and so on, because we're talking about nested intervals here, you're only going to get bigger and bigger real. So you have C sub I is strictly less than A sub N, which is less than or equal to A sub N plus 1, which is less than or equal to A sub N plus 2, which is less than or equal to A sub N plus 3, and so on. Now, what we do is we choose M choose M larger than N, and choose M to be large enough that two to the minus M times the original diameter B minus A is less than the distance from D minus from D sub I to X. Then our situation is that C sub I is less than or equal to A sub N, which is less than or equal to A sub M, which is less than or equal to X, because X is an upper bound of the A sub N's, all the A sub K's, say, for natural numbers K. And then... because we've chosen M sufficiently large, we have that the distance from B sub M to A sub M is less than the distance from X to D sub I. So we actually have that B sub M must be less than D sub I, because otherwise you would have X and D sub I between A sub M and B sub M, and that would make the distance between A sub M and B sub M at least as big as the distance from D sub I to X. So we've chosen M big enough that the A sub M and the B sub M fit strictly in between C sub I and D sub I. And note that x is also less than or equal to b sub m because x is the least upper bound of all the a's, and because the intervals are nested, then as we argued in the proof of the nested intervals theorem, b is an upper bound of all the a's as well. X being the least upper bound has to be less than or equal to all the other upper bounds, including b sub m. Well, now we have a contradiction, because we have an interval a sub m, b sub m that's not covered by finitely many of the c sub i, d sub i intervals. Yet now we've actually shown that just one of those intervals actually already does cover it. So that's our contradiction. So if we're going to keep what we supposed at the beginning of our proof, that the closed interval AB has no finite covering by these open intervals, if we're going to keep that assumption, then we have to throw away our assumption that we have our point X here covered by one of the C sub I, D sub I open intervals. Okay. So actually, for all I in the index set, X is not in the open interval C sub I, D sub I. So that's how the bisection argument works. It shows that if there's this global failure of finite covering, then by repeatedly cutting in half, we can localize to just a point where we have failure of finite covering. And actually, for a point, if you cover a point with finitely many open intervals, that's just the same as saying one of the intervals cover it. So actually, the localized failure of finite covering just amounts to there's a point not covered at all. So in contrapositive form, Heine-Borel states what we just proved. If your closed interval is not covered by any finite subcollection of some family of open intervals, then actually the whole family is not enough to cover the closed interval. We'll turn that around by taking the contrapositive again to put it back in the original form, and it says that if your closed interval is covered by a family of open intervals, then actually a finite subfamily of those intervals is enough to do the covering. All right, let's go on to page 7. Okay, now I want to come back to something in section 2.3, which is the notion of a limit point, also called an accumulation point, also called a cluster point. Okay? So, if you have a set A of reals, and then you have a real X, we want to say that X is infinitely close to A in a non-trivial way. If you can get as close as you want to X using points from A, but without cheating. I mean, we're not interested in the case where, oh, X itself is already in A, so I'm distant zero away from a point in A. No, we want to say that X is going to be as close as you want to points in A other than x itself. So in terms of our distance between points and sets notion, which involved a greatest lower bound, we're just saying that the distance from x to A, take away singleton x, is zero. This notion of limit point gives us an important additional characterization of when a set is closed. So A is closed if and only if every limit point of A is already in A. Okay. Here's a little proof. If remember that A is closed if and only if for every x in the complement of A, the distance from x to A is positive. Now, for x's in the complement of A, if you change that A to A take away x, you don't change A at all because x is not in A. So A is closed if and only if for all x in the complement of A, the distance from x to A minus singleton x is positive. Okay. So in other words, A is closed if and only if for every x in the complement of A, A is not in the set A prime of all limit points of A. But saying for all x in the complement of A, A is not in A prime, that's just saying if x is not in A, then x is not in A prime. We could take the contrapositive of that, and you're just saying that for everything that is in A prime, it must also be in A. Which is just another way of saying that A prime is a subset of A. Now, if you combine the Heine-Borel theorem with the notion of limit point, you get another very interesting thing, which is that if A is a subset of the reals, and A is both bounded and infinite, then A has a limit point. Easy example would be the set 1 over 1, 1 over 2, 1 over 3, 1 over 4, and so on. It has a limit point. Actually, the way I rigged this set, it has exactly one limit point, 0. On the other hand, if you consider, say, the natural numbers, there, that's an infinite set, but it's not bounded. And it actually has no limit points. Because if you look at any real, then if you look at all the integers, not including that real itself, because that real might be an integer, but if we exclude that real itself, and then we ask, how far away is it to an integer? The answer is going to be a positive number, right? If x is an integer, then the closest integers other than x are one away. And if x is not an integer, then you have to go some positive distance to get to an integer, right? You either go down to the nearest integer, up to the nearest integer, but there's some minimum positive distance you have to go. So there are no limit points of the set of integers or of the set of natural numbers. Now go to page 8, and we mentioned briefly what happens in the plane. The definitions of open and closed and limit point in terms of distance are the same, except we have to use the planar notion of distance. We use the Euclidean distance, right? So the distance between two points A comma B and C comma D. We have to watch out now because now we're talking about points, not intervals, when we have the parentheses and the comma here. So we use the Euclidean formula. But otherwise, the distance definitions are the same. We're just using a different distance. And eventually we're going to abstract this to saying for any reasonable distance notion, you get a corresponding notion of open and closed and limit point. And you would also like to have some easier to visualize notions of open and close for the plane. And probably the best one is that a subset of the plane is open if and only if it's a union of open balls. Now, what is an open ball? A ball is just the higher dimensional generalization of an interval x minus delta to x plus delta, right? You think about an interval with center x and radius delta, right? You have to go delta to the left, delta to the right to get to get outside of this interval with center x. Now generalize that to higher dimensions, right? As long as you have some distance function here, whether it's the one-dimensional or two-dimensional distance function, you just say that the ball with center x and radius delta is just the set of all points y where the distance from x to y is less than delta. Okay. And so a subset of the plane is open if and only if it is a union of open balls. There's also a notion of closed balls, which Krum denotes using a square brackets instead of parentheses. And that's just where the distance from x to y is less than or equal to delta. So this is the higher dimensional analog of when you just have a closed interval from x minus delta to x plus delta. Now, let me tell you about your homework. I'm not going to have the graduate students do any extra homework for this assignment. It's just going to be same problems for all of you. So look at 2.3, numbers 2 and 7. 2.4, numbers 4 and 6. And 2.5, numbers 1 and 3. All right. That's it for this day.